Counsel for the defense, you may proceed.
Judge Efron, members of the court, it's my honor again to stand before this court and represent a member of the Armed Forces of the United States, Private Charles Grainer, who I believe is a political prisoner of the failed United States-Iraq policy and unnecessary war. Private Grainer remains confined today more than 2 years and 7 months after the last of his co-accused were released from military prison, a fact that I find personally a stain on the military justice system. With that said, I would like to discuss Granite Issue 1, which relates to the failure of the military judge to order disclosure of certain U.S. government memos that approved enhanced interrogation tactics for detainees in U.S. custody and the legal justification therefor.
Can you start on your brief? It wasn't clear to me. If it was clear, I missed it, how you responded to the government's argument that the memos were either publicly available, produced to the defendant, or both. The briefs talk past each other on that point. And what is your response to that?
My response to that is, Your Honor, that is with respect to the first claim that they were publicly available, I believe that the evidence is to the contrary. The government made a claim of privilege, which is contained in the joint appendix at Joint Appendix, page 354. The claim of privilege means that the document was classified.
Wait, be clear which document you're talking about, because there are at least three memos in play, or perhaps more or less.
Perhaps more. Yes, Your Honor.
And so when you say there was a claim of privilege,
with respect to the document that was specifically requested, because it was the only one identified with particularity in the newspaper article that had been leaked, the contents of that memo, the civilian defense counsel at the trial identified with particularity the document that he asked for. The government made a claim of privilege. The government now claims that it had been declassified the day after. The day after the hearing on the motion in Iraq. Now, as you're well aware, Your Honor,
it claims that, and was it in fact?
I don't know. I think it may have been, but I don't think it was disclosed to the defense. And most importantly, having made a claim of privilege, I believe the trial counsel and the government were ethically bound to identify the fact that it had been declassified the day after they took that position in a court.
Was it merely declassified, or was it made public in some fashion?
I don't believe it was made public.
Are we at liberty to take judicial notice of DOD press releases?
Certainly.
Have you looked at the June 22, 2004 DOD press release?
Well, Your Honor, that may be true, but I believe under the law, after the government takes a position that something is classified and not going to be disclosed, that they had a duty to bring it to the attention of the defense that it had been.
Even if they didn't disclose it?
Yes, Your Honor.
Even if the defense could, with, it sounds like, not too much trouble, find it.
Well, that's the question. The government has taken a position the day before.
No. It appears to have been made public, or that there is at least some indication it was at the time. And it would have seemed that defense counsel with reasonable diligence could have found that out.
And I believe that they did make that effort and that they did not come up with it, Your Honor. Otherwise, we would have seen it. At some point, we've been in the discovery materials that were provided by the government.
Counsel, does anything in the record establish what the status of that document was on the date that the judge denied the motion?
It was classified.
It was classified at that date. And does anything in the record establish whether the trial counsel in this case advised the defense counsel that the document was no longer classified?
Nothing in the record.
So if we assume that the document was declassified and was made public, what does the record show before us as to where the document was available?
The record shows?
What does the record before us show, either the trial or the appellate record or the records that either party seeks to establish by a motion here at the court? What does the record before us establish as to where that document existed if it was made public?
On some sort of DOD website.
On a DOD website. And whose obligation is it under the law, after a discovery request is made for a specific document, and the government states that the document is classified, whose obligation at that point is it to inform the court, irrespective of either party, as to where the document is and what its status is?
It's the trial counsel's responsibility, Your Honor. And I believe that the trial counsel either should have known, or in the exercise of reasonable diligence, had they followed rule for court martial or military rule of evidence 505, would have discovered that the document was in the process of declassification, if in fact that is the case, Your Honor. Because military rule of evidence 505, once the government claims privilege, and that's the gravamen of my argument, Your Honor, is that once the government claims privilege, the military judge abused his discretion in not complying with military rule of evidence 505, which has a set of procedures that must be followed in order to verify the claim of privilege and then make a decision as to whether or not, having made the claim of privilege, that claim should be sustained.
But if the military judge were to decide that the document was irrelevant, putting aside the question of whether the judge should or should not have made the decision on irrelevancy based on an in-camera decision, is there anything that obligates the judge to go through a Rule 505 proceeding if the judge decides that it's irrelevant?
Without looking at the document, without knowing what the document said, I don't...
Based on a proffer. In other words, I'm not asking you to concede that the proffer did or did not establish that, but isn't it within the authority of the military judge, based on a proffer, to determine that a document is irrelevant and that a Rule 505 proceeding is not necessary?
He can make that determination, but I believe that an in-camera review of a document is required. Because it's impossible for a judge to exercise the discretion if he doesn't know what the document actually says.
What if it's not a classified document? If there's a proffer with respect to a document, isn't it within the prerogative of the military judge to determine that the judge need not examine the document in camera before denying discovery? Can't the judge determine that based on the proffer, that it doesn't meet the discovery test? I'm not asking you to concede that it does in this case. I'm just talking about your argument that he had to go through a 505 proceeding. I don't understand that. If the judge properly determined that, it was irrelevant.
Without a particular set of facts, yes, I believe that is a theoretical possibility, Your Honor.
Thank you.
There are two bridges the judge seems to have created for the defense that had to get over. And one of them was... The military judge repeatedly said, how do these documents relate to this case? And then the second bridge appears to be the link between military intelligence and what the MPs were doing. There's a lot of back and forth during the proceeding as to the pressure military intelligence folks were feeling to produce information. But the next bridge that the appellant was faced with was, how do I link that to my MP? Can you please articulate to me what in the record gets you across both those bridges?
Oh, we're talking about
if you accept the question. I mean, you can rephrase it, but no, you see my point.
If we're talking about the entire appellate record, including the documents we've submitted for the consideration of the court, the first question, it's relevant in that it establishes, one, that the government took the position that the detainees were unlawful enemy combatants, not entitled to any protections or the protections of the discretion of the sovereign. I view that as a statement of law that by establishing harsh interrogation techniques, by changing the FM, the field manual definitions, the Secretary of Defense had modified the elements of the offense, which the President is allowed to define under Article 36, of maltreatment, dereliction of duty, assault, with respect to the category of people who are detained as unlawful enemy.
And therefore, in your view, it did not matter whether the appellant himself was aware of these documents and memos?
Correct. Those memos were relevant to a cognizable legal defense, that being a response to orders in a situation.
How about the second bridge?
The second bridge, could you remind me what that was?
I can introduce a different metaphor, too, if you'd like, if that'd be helpful.
I'm happy to answer that question.
There's a fair bit of back and forth as to what military intelligence people may or may not have thought, felt, et cetera. This is the Major Ponce, the Mr. Brokaw type stuff. And it appears that the military judge is skeptical as to relevance because the appellant, in the military judge's view, not necessarily yours or mine, did not make the link between what the military intelligence people felt or did or thought and what the MPs felt or did or thought.
And one of the problems in this case was that every person in a position of leadership in military intelligence invoked their right to remain silent because they were potential targets of the investigation. So we're left with Mr. Brokaw, who says that they were pushed for reporting on intelligence, material evidence of intelligence value. That's in Mr. Brokaw's testimony. And we have Major Ponce's email, which I believe that it's that you could not help but believe that the battle captain in the intelligence unit who's pushing down to all the interrogators in the theater, that message would not have gotten to the people at military intelligence. I think it's...
But there's no... You're making an inference. I don't want to... You're making an inference, but there's no direct evidence of that. Is that fair to say?
Well, there is direct evidence from testimony of soldiers that MI was directing the MPs. The MI had come and brought people from Guantanamo to change techniques. There's evidence in the record.
Citing to the record pages, please, what is your best evidence that that link was established as between the pressure the MI were feeling? And you can do this on rebuttal, but this is your chance to say these are the three pages of the seven things I want you to look at to make the link between what MI felt and did and what these, or in particular this appellant, did or thought. But I want specific record pages that you believe get you over that bridge.
Counsel, in a related... Please. Judge Baker, were you finished with your question?
Yeah, I was just saying please. I was adding that.
If the defense had received all the documents, which the defense now contends were not properly disclosed, and if the military judge had admitted all the evidence, which the defense now argues should have been admitted, what particular incidents, that is, what part of each document or excluded evidence would you have asked the court-martial panel to consider for purposes of addressing the government's burden, as articulated by the military judge, to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that a soldier of ordinary common sense would have understood the order to perform the charge acts was unlawful? That is, what are the specifics in those documents or those evidence, the piece of evidence that you couldn't get in, that you would have said to the members, see, someone is authorized to do X, and X is either the same as or similar to what my client is accused of. I don't really get the detail from the brief, and my question is, isn't that important for us to know in deciding whether there's prejudice or not, assuming that discovery was unlawfully withheld?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe Defense Appellate Exhibit B, which is an annex from the Iraqi Working Group, basically lays out how military interrogators are to be assisted by MPs, how the MPs are to set out the conditions for successful interrogation. And the record is filled with references to how the MPs were directed to do that. Naked detainees, detainees who were hooded, detainees who were handcuffed from the ceiling, detainees who were subject to oppressive heat and cold, loud noises, yelling, gooseneck come-alongs. So there are, the record is replete with what the MPs were employed to do on behalf of military intelligence.
And what argument would you make, Judge Baker?
How do you how do you get from there to a naked pyramid? Are you arguing command climate and they took it upon themselves? Or are you saying that MI told them to do that?
No, I'm not saying that he was told, that Private Granite was told to do the naked pyramid. But I'm saying that the command climate promoted a permissive environment with these detainees that, for example, the technique called the ego up or ego down, putting detainees in the nude is that would qualify as harming the ego of the detainees. But the particular pyramid issue, though, the evidence showed that had been used in corrections in the United States at the Walpole State Prison and at Attica. So in my view, that was excluded to the detriment of Private Grainer because it was a technique that the expert who had testified about had been used. The fact that it wasn't generally accepted doesn't mean under the unique circumstances of the detainees at Abu Ghraib that it shouldn't be used under those circumstances.
Thank you, Counselor. Thank you, Your Honor. Further opportunity on rebuttal. Counsel for the government.
Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Captain Chad Fisher, and I, along with Colonel Warren Allen, represent the United States. This Court should grant appellant no relief on Issue 1 and affirm the decision of the Army Court of Criminal Appeals on Issue 2 for three reasons. First, appellant forfeited Issue 1 at trial by not renewing his motion to compel, and the military judge made no error. Second, appellant has not proved any documents were withheld from the defense. And third, the military judge correctly excluded Major Ponce's email and Mr. Archambault's testimony. If I could turn first to granted Issue 1, appellant bears the burden of proving plain error on Issue 1 because he forfeited this issue. He did not renew the motion to compel at trial despite being expressly invited to do so by the military judge.
Did the military judge invite him to renew the motion in the sense of saying, this is a tentative motion on my part, I haven't ruled? Or did he rule definitively that the motion was denied and told counsel, if you develop further evidence, I'll consider it anew?
Your Honor, he did not rule definitively. It was, in my view, it was a preliminary ruling based on a couple things, Your Honor. First, we looked at his language. The military judge said, based on what I have before me now and looking at the evidence before me now, I find it's not relevant. Then we have to look at the military judge's actions, which was he ordered the government to make available certain high-ranking witnesses, which would have been able to develop any materiality or relevance of those documents. So not only did he couch his language.
But let's assume that produced nothing for the defense.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Let's assume that produced nothing for the defense. Why would the defense have been required to renew a motion for which they had no additional evidence? That is, if the defense believed that they had sufficient evidence at the time they made their motion, and if the judge determined that it wasn't sufficient evidence, why isn't that a definitive ruling denying the motion at that time?
Well, Your Honor, I think that kind of ties into what this Court said in Browning and Rockwood, which is, I mean, we don't expect the military judge to have clairvoyance at that stage. Page, I think that this is between pages 70 and 90 in the record. There was plenty of opportunity for the appellant to develop that relevance that may have existed through interviews with the chain of command. And, Your Honor, even if this Court reviews for abuse of discretion, the military judge still made no error in ruling on the motion. In reviewing the Court's decision, the trial court's decision, this Court should look to the facts that were before the military judge at the time. And the starting point for that analysis would be appellant's proffer for the relevance of these documents, which was, number one, that it would control the state of the law, and number two, that it was relevant to appellant's state of mind. The military judge correctly found that the state of law argument did not hold water, that the document was not relevant to the state of the law, and also the military judge found there was no evidence of a connection to appellant's state of mind.
Where did the defense say that they needed this to prove the defense state of mind?
Your Honor, I believe that was at Joint Appendix 25 and 26, just prior to the military judge's ruling. Finally, just before the military judge issued his preliminary ruling, he was mindful of the liberal grant of discovery before he articulated. Moving on, appellant also alleges there's a Brady violation in this case, which is arguably outside the scope of granted Issue 1, which deals with the military judge's error at trial.
As I read 25 and 26, the defense counsel was responding to the judge's questions about state of mind. Where did the defense counsel say that state of mind is our issue?
Oh, Your Honor, I think it's right on that last paragraph of Joint Appendix 25. That these documents could very well, the last two lines, Your Honor, that these documents could very well.
What do the first two lines say of defense counsel's point there?
He refers to an earlier hearing, Your Honor. Is that the line you're referring?
You asked about the state of mind of the individuals.
Yes, Your Honor. In an earlier hearing,
right.
I think that was a separate case.
Was it necessary for the defense to prove anything about state of mind in this case?
Yes, Your Honor. If the appellant wants to move to compel these documents, they would bear the burden of establishing that connection.
Why? The defense of obedience to orders only requires state of mind with respect to if the first part of the test, that if the individual knew the order was unlawful. But the second part of the test, as stated in Cali, and it's repeated in the rule itself, is an objective test, and that is what a reasonable soldier would know. The state of mind, as I understand it, is irrelevant to the defense at that point. And that was the Judge Darden in the Cali case wanted to go to the individual's personal view. That was the dissent. The majority said, no, we're going to have an objective test here, and that's what was in the 1951 manual embodied in the current manual. So why is his state of mind pertinent at all to the discovery request?
Well, Your Honor, I think the first part of the test is just a subjective analysis, so I think that's where it would be relevant. But also, as the moving party, appellant would bear the burden of establishing that connection, therefore, that's where the appellant's state of mind.
And if he did establish the connection as to what a reasonable soldier would know, then he would get discovery. If he didn't establish it, he wouldn't get discovery. Is that correct?
Well, Your Honor, I can't say definitively what the military judge would rule, but it would be a much closer case had they established that link or presented evidence of the link.
What's your response to the appellant's argument and Judge Efron's questions regarding the government's duty to inform on the privilege issue?
Your Honor, I think the first point on that is I don't believe the government invoked privilege as the basis for withholding this document. Now, don't deny the fact that the word classified is written in Appellate Exhibit 9. But if you read Appellate Exhibit 9 in full and you look to the 39A that they had on the motion to compel, the government's basis for objecting is relevant. So that's just a threshold matter, Your Honor. The second piece of that, I'm sorry, what was your question again?
What's your response to their what's your response to appellant's argument that even if these things were made publicly available between the request and the trial counsel never brought that to the attention of the court?
Yes, Your Honor. They may not have brought it to the attention of the court, but we would not know if they brought it to the attention of the defense, because that type of thing just wouldn't be in the record. If the government hands over 1,000 pages of discovery and there's no issue, then that type of thing just wouldn't be in the record. It's only...
Well, presumably, it would be in the record of what was delivered as part of the discovery. Did they deliver the document to the defense between the date of request and the trial?
Yes, Your Honor. According to the affidavit that we submitted to this court, they did.
And the appellant says they didn't, so we're sort of...
Yes, Your Honor. They claimed that in their pleadings, but however, the government has provided a sworn affidavit. If I could just touch on that briefly, that goes to my second.
Is there not a package of documents indicating with date stamp and date and all that when exactly the document was provided?
I don't have that, Your Honor, no. But that may exist.
Okay.
I thought that the question was whether or not you had delivered the information to the court that the document had been unclassified. I thought that that was the question.
Yes, Your Honor. I apologize. There's no evidence in the record that that was done. And if I could just touch on that, I think regarding the appellant's Brady claims, as this court has held in Guthrie and Strickler, the appellant has the burden of proving nondisclosure. And this court has specifically dealt with naked assertions and pleadings, and has found that in the past to be insufficient, and the court should again find that appellant's pleadings.
What case stands for the proposition that when the government submits a document to the court and asserts that the underlying requested document is both classified and irrelevant, that is insufficient to meet the defense burden for showing that the document wasn't produced?
Regarding the working group report, Your Honor, you're referring
right.
to the one to trial. I don't have case law to support that, Your Honor. Only the gap in time, which is that this happened in June and trial was not until January, and there are a number of things that could happen within that 7-month time frame. Specifically regarding, if I could just touch on Major General Miller's assessment, which was Defense Appellate Exhibit Bravo, or the pending Defense Appellate Exhibit Bravo, which appellant cites as the main cause of prejudice. I think the record definitively establishes, regardless of any affidavit submitted to this court, the record definitively establishes that document was indeed made available to the defense as part of Major General Tacuba's 15-6 investigation. And just for the court, that it's mentioned in our brief, but page 2 of Defense Exhibit Juliet, as well as the military judge confirmed numerous times throughout the record that the Tacuba report was indeed available. If I could just further discuss the prejudice analysis, the government doesn't concede that the documents were discoverable. However, assuming the court finds non-disclosure, appellant suffered no prejudice in this case. The working group report, which is the only document that was specifically requested, any non-disclosure of this document was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. And the court can look to appellant's own actions to establish this. In discussing the circumstances that led to appellant's misconduct, appellant's position at trial was that the Secretary of Defense was too far removed. And that's at Joint Appendix page 37. Regarding General Miller's visit to Iraq, appellant's position at trial was that General Miller's visit means nothing to anyone and they don't have a dog in this fight. That's at Joint Appendix page 55.
Now you said, I'm sorry, finish your sentence if you'd like.
That was it.
You said that the only memo that was specifically requested was the working group memo?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Now, what about on record 88? This may be a question of how technical one gets, but we are talking about a memo from the Department of Justice, from various staff, judge advocates, and the general counsel to the President of the United States, to the CIA and other government agencies.
Yes,
so they haven't, in your view, specifically identified what they want?
No, Your Honor, not especially compared when you compare it to what they were able to articulate with the work group.
Now, did they have a menu of all the memos that were available at this time?
I don't believe they did, Your Honor.
So you don't think that's a specific memo from the Department of Justice is not specific to the Secretary of Defense is not specific enough to let the government know what they're requesting?
No, Your Honor, it's not.
So how do they get past the Catch-22? If everything's classified, they hear rumors of a memo from Justice to DOD, and you're requiring them to state the date and who to from? I don't get it. How do you get past that hurdle?
Your Honor, I think there is a you don't know what you don't know argument to be made there. But I think the military judge in this case took care of that by ordering the government to make available everybody who was in the armed chain of command, to include the CENTCOM commander.
No, but that goes to prejudice or something else. But I'm asking you, does this qualify as a specific request for a document? And you said no. And my question is, then how would they ever be able to request a document in the classified world if all they can do is say to from?
Well, Your Honor, I think, again, this kind of goes to the timing, which is this motion happens at page 70. We know that later on in the record, page 70 through 90, I'm sorry, Your Honor. We know that later in the record, defense had security clearances and they had means and methods to identify and review classified documents. So they had the facility to articulate with specificity those documents, especially through the interviews with the chain of command, if the chain of command had seen these documents or had any knowledge of these documents.
So they're at fault for not then interviewing people and saying, please give us the specific date that we're trying to get at here in the memo.
No, Your Honor, and I think this ties into the prejudice piece, which we can look at the interviews with Major General Miller, and we can look at the interviews with Lieutenant General Sanchez, where the appellant didn't ask any questions about the SecDef's.
And remember, I'm asking you not a question about prejudice, but a question about how someone in a litigation that inherently involves classified information can go about discovery, in the government's view, if they can't identify the to whom and date.
I think, Your Honor, we have to look at what did the government do to provide them access? What did the government do to remove those hurdles of discovery? And in this case, it was making available the entire chain of command and as well giving them security clearances and the like.
What was the highest level of chain of command that was made available to the defense?
Your Honor, based on the record, I know that General Abizade was interviewed, which was the...
Was General Abizade a participant in either the DOD working group or the Department of Justice group that put together the memo?
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor.
Then why would access to those individuals provide any relief to defendant in terms of identifying the document that Judge Baker talked about?
Because, Your Honor, if they relied on that document in any way in establishing policy at every grade, then they would be able to articulate
what
that.
What if they didn't? What if the defense argument wanted to use that material at trial to show that if the Department of Justice officials and the Department of Defense officials believe that a particular act was permissible, then a soldier of common sense and understanding could also find that act permissible. I'm not asking you to concede that the equivalence was made there, but isn't that one of the reasons why the defense could use the material in this case, not to show that General Avezade or General Miller or anybody particularly read that document, but that it demonstrated the standard of what a reasonable soldier could undertake?
I understand that, Your Honor. I think they still have to present evidence of a connection to Evergreen.
How about page 2 of the working group document that specifically says that the views that they put together therein were informed by a Department of Justice opinion? Now, I assume that trial counsel had the same access that you referenced to as defense counsel to the documents that were on the Internet. Now, why wouldn't it have been trial counsel's obligation to take a look at that document, see that it referenced State Department of Justice opinion, know that the defense was asking for a Department of Justice opinion, and seek out the document that is specifically referenced on page 2 of the working group document?
Well, Your Honor, they may have done that. There's no proof that appellant never received these documents.
Was the trial counsel obligated under Rule 701 to undertake a reasonable search to find the document that had been identified by the defense, a Department of Justice document that is then referenced in the DOD working group, and find that, provide it to the defense, or claim a privilege for not providing it?
I believe they may have, Your Honor. I believe there may be an obligation. I believe they may have done that. Again, there's no proof that the document was withheld. And if I see him running a long time, if I can move to grand issue number 2.
Before you move.
Yes, Your Honor.
There seems to be an enormous amount of fog and confusion about the facts here, about these documents. Do we need a debate?
No, Your Honor, you do not.
Why don't we?
The court can decide this issue based on the record before them at this time. Regarding as far as the issue was raised as the military judge erred at trial, the court can decide that based on his ruling and appellant's proffers. To the extent this is raised as a Brady issue, the court can decide that appellant has not met their burden of proving any withholding of documents. Moving to grand addition number 2, Major Ponce's email and testimony were relevant to this case and were properly excluded by the military judge. Turning first to the email was relevant because the military judge found no evidence of a connection to Abergrave or to appellant. And again, I think the starting point for the analysis is the defense proffer on why it was relevant. And the defense proffered that it was like directions from the MI community to interrogators at Evergreen, authorizing aggressive techniques. And based on that proffer, the military judge found it was relevant for 2 reasons. First and most important, the military judge found there was no evidence of a logical connection to Evergreen. The military judge at Joint Appendix 123 asked appellant's defense counsel, "Do you have any evidence that this email went to anybody at Evergreen?" And the appellant's response was, "No, sir." The military judge also found that the email was too remote in time based on the publication of the CJTF-7 interrogation plans. Moving to regarding Major Ponce's testimony, the military judge found in that case, although originally permitting him to testify about pressure on the intelligence community, he reconsidered his ruling and properly found that Major Ponce could not talk about any pressure at Abu Ghraib, and that's where Mr. Brokaw comes in. He's able to talk personally, through personal knowledge of pressure.
In the abstract, if it were demonstrated that there was an absence of guidance on how to deal with detainees, do you think that might be mitigating on sentence?
No, Your Honor, I don't.
Let's say the Major Ponce email is 4 square in the time and date that the Abu Ghraib issue occurred.
Yes, sir.
So you didn't take the date issue off the table. Why wouldn't that be relevant in some manner in mitigation to what young soldiers knew or did not know as to how they dealt with people?
Well, I think there's evidence in the record to address that point, Your Honor, which is that Specialist Liang testified that regardless of her training, regardless of whether or not she remembered her Geneva training, she knew that the things that were on this charge sheet were unlawful. So I think there's evidence in the record to show that that would not be relevant, regardless of what their status was, regardless of...
Why wouldn't it... that says it might not be prejudicial, but why wouldn't it be helpful in mitigation to a young soldier to point out that a commissioned officer, was operating in a vacuum regarding how to deal with detainees?
It may be helpful, Your Honor, but there was a significant amount of direct evidence regarding the lack of training, regarding all that. And I think that was sufficiently presented at trial. So the answer to your question, Your Honor, I think
could be mitigating, yes, but was otherwise overwhelmed.
Yes, Your Honor.
Counsel, the military judge ruled in this case that any order that the appellant would have received would have been an unlawful order. I'm not sure what the basis of that was. Is it the view of the government that any order to any soldier to undertake the acts that were performed in this act would be an unlawful order? I'm not talking about the particular circumstances. I'm talking about an order to do X, Y, and Z, the charged acts. Are they inherently unlawful?
Your Honor, I don't think I can speak in absolutes.
Well, what was the basis for the military judge's ruling then?
Your Honor, I don't believe that's in the record. I think the basis for the military judge's ruling was...
Well, did he err?
No, Your Honor, he did not. I think the basis...
Well, what's the government's position then as to whether these particular acts are lawful or unlawful?
The government's position is, Your Honor, regarding the acts on the charge sheet and on the flyer, is that the military judge properly determined that they were unlawful. If there were orders...
If there was an order to do those things, and what is the authority that the government now cites for determining that those acts are unlawful acts and that no government official can order any U.S. soldier to undertake those acts?
I think the government's authority, Your Honor, has to be the military judge's ruling, or instructions, rather. I'm sorry. I tried.
Well, we review that de novo now. We're reviewing de novo the correctness of the military judge's order in that case, which is pertinent to the two granted issues. What's the authority that would support the military judge's ruling that these orders were unlawful?
Well, Your Honor, I don't have specifics for you. The only thing I can cite to you would be this court's decision in the United States v. New, which puts the lawfulness of the order with... It makes the lawfulness of the order a decision for the military judge.
As I recall, New, this court then undertook a de novo review of the correctness of those orders. So what do we rely on now?
Your Honor, I don't have anything for you at this time.
Thank you.
I see my time is up.
You may briefly conclude if you'd like to.
The military judge made no error denying appellant's motion to compel production, nor did he err in excluding Major Ponce's email and the testimony of Mr. Archambeau. This court should grant appellant.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
I do briefly. First, with respect to Judge Baker's question, sir, I have citations for you, sir. Joint Appendix 79, Private Frederick testified that he was taking directions from military intelligence. Joint Appendix 576, Brokaw testified that he was receiving external pressure to produce so many reports, some number of reports per week. Joint Appendix 88, 89.
Is that the quota testimony?
Pardon me, sir?
Is that when he talks about quotas?
Yes, Your Honor. Joint Appendix 88 and 89, witnesses testifying that his predecessor from the unit that they replaced, the MPs replaced, was told that wearing women's panties, handcuffing detainees, and wearing hoods was what MI wanted. Joint Appendix 91, according to Captain Brinson, the soldiers were supposed to follow MI's instructions. 94 and 95, we took orders from military intelligence. I don't think there's any question but that military intelligence was running that prison, and they were telling these MPs what to do. You can't get the question that Chief Judge Efron asked is particularly pertinent. How is a guard to know the difference between it's okay to put women's panties on a prisoner, it's okay to put him in a cold cell or a hot cell? How is a soldier supposed to know the difference? I mean, it's obvious. They're in the global war on terrorism, and they're trying to get actionable intelligence. They understand what the mission is in that facility.
Now, relate that argument to the two issues that are before the court, and therefore, the working group memo what?
The working group memo and the legal memos connect up the question of whether or not an average soldier would believe under the circumstances that he was acting lawfully and in accordance with lawful orders based on the circumstances that were in that prison at that time. And you've got to remember what's going on in the war at this time. The war's not going so well in the fall of 2003. That's why, we didn't know this, we learned it from the Senate report. The Senate report identifies the fact that on August 4th, Captain Wood, who was in charge of interrogations at that prison, asked for some additional, more aggressive techniques. On the 14th, you get Captain Ponce's email, And in, contained in that email, you'll notice that there's a an email from a chief warrant officer who wants to be able to slap detainees. So that's a chief warrant officer. That's a guy in MI who wants to, the authority to be able to slap detainees, which is, frankly, an assault consummated by a battery. How, if these experts in military intelligence are to know, don't know the difference on what's appropriate and what's not, how is a soldier who is told he's taking direction from military intelligence to make that call? They were being told that this was important to the global war on terrorism and saving Americans' lives.
Where
Judge Scott, yeah, I completely agree. A debate hearing is appropriate.
Where in the record does defense counsel argue that these memos are necessary for the mitigation on sentencing?
I don't have it.
That's one of your arguments.
That's one of my arguments.
Court, but I was trying to find it as before the military judge.
I don't think you have to make every argument, Your Honor. I think if you make the argument that they're relevant as to one area, that they could be relevant to others. I'm pointing out that as a matter of law, I believe that they would be relevant to the mitigation phase. I don't have a page citation for mitigation for you, but I think that's inherent in making the request and drawing the conclusion that it goes to the state of mind. I think that's even if you find that there's a crime, if you have the state of, if you don't have the state of mind, or if your state of mind is altered by outside factors, I believe that you could argue that that's a mitigation factor. The reason Dubé is appropriate, Your Honor, I think the government has made the argument that because defense counsel had a security clearance, that they were entitled to go and just kind of willy-nilly look at all the documents that might be classified that might have to do with the global war on terrorism. That is completely false. And the government has not made any assertion that the legal memos from the Office of Legal Counsel to the Department of Defense were in the package of documents that they had, the classified document tranche that they had available to defense to look at. And in my view, the defense made a sufficient request for that document to be produced, that the military judge should have followed the rules, should have had the convening authority take first initial actions required by the Rule 505, and then if the convening authority chose not to dismiss the charge or not to produce the evidence, hold it in camera, review the document in camera with an affidavit from a member from the governing agency that controls that document to determine whether or not it should be released. When the judge doesn't follow the rules, the rule that governs the classified information, he abuses his discretion because he failed to follow the rule that governs his exercise of discretion, Your Honor. If there are no more questions, Your Honor, I believe that this court should set aside the findings of guilty and order a rehearing in the case, in the Private Grainer's case, because of the failure to provide this material and relevant evidence that would have informed the judgment both of the defense counsel and of the court. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We did enter a number of areas that were not on rebuttal, that were beyond rebuttal in fairness and questions to the judges. And if I don't know if the government has anything further, but if they do, I'd give them a brief opportunity to address any areas that were not within rebuttal, or would you rest on your briefs at this point? Thank you. The case is now submitted. The court will stand in recess pending further order of the court. We thank counsel for both parties for your presentation today.